from around the world, as you just mentioned, and especially in the UK, flooding the streets. If I'm not mistaken, you helped organize this protest, right? And so I wanted to ask you, I mean, what does it take to sustain a movement like that, to keep a sentiment of anti-war, anti-imperialism going in the public? And how important is it to have public opinion against the wars in the first place?
There were a number of different elements to building a movement. First of all, it was trying to establish the broadest possible kind of coalition of forces, which meant getting, obviously, people from the left, campaigning hard to get the unions on board, which is something we managed to do, most of the trade unions in Britain, starting with the more militant unions, but gradually kind of pushing outwards from that base. Crucially, the Muslim communities in Britain, we approached, sometimes they approached us. We worked very, very closely together with them, and that was very important in terms of even the first demonstration in November, November 2001, there was a large number of people from, you know, the Muslim community in Britain on the demonstration, which was a very, very powerful statement. I think it had a big effect on people.
You recently wrote an article, I think, in the Morning Star about the 20-year anniversary of 9/11, and you mentioned that, quote, supporters of the invasion claim that there were advances in the country under occupation, but that the facts suggest otherwise. Can you give us some examples of that?
Well, I mean, the two things that are commonly said by defenders of the war, apologists for the war in Afghanistan, are that there was a health service that was built up that was, you know, a massive improvement, and B, that women's lives have improved. And I think really, fundamentally, neither thing is true. I mean, Afghanistan spends 0.6 of its percent of its GDP on health, which is one of the lowest percentages anywhere in the world, and stands against an average in South Asia of 5%. So, I mean, health provision is absolutely diabolical in the country. That's the truth. And secondly, on the issue of advances for women, I think there were some advances for women in more middle class or elite circles in the cities. But in general, life for women in Afghanistan has been as bad, if not worse, as it has for everyone else. I mean, 240,000 people have been killed by the war, just, you know, to start with. But also the devastation of the infrastructure, the general violence and lawlessness in the country, all of these things have impacted massively on women's lives. And actually, if you look at the stats, the levels of literacy for women in Afghanistan are the worst anywhere in the world. Only 18% of women in Afghanistan are literate at this point, after this so-called progress. So I think, unfortunately, this is war propaganda. It was used at the time of the launch of the war, and it's now being used to desperately try and justify the unjustifiable, and to try and pretend that what has happened in Afghanistan was anything other than an absolute disaster. So, you know, I don't think we should allow the people who support the war to get away with this kind of nonsense. They also talk about economic progress. Look at the World Bank statistics. Look at the UN statistics. There has been no economic progress in Afghanistan in the last 20 years. In fact, most indexes suggest that it's gone backwards, which is not surprising, because that's what happens when you bombard a country with, you know, with a huge amount of munitions and send troops rampaging through the streets of towns and cities. You know, this isn't a particularly sensible economic strategy.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
But even the average American, they've also lost in this war, and not only because The politicians use them like cannon fodder, sending them off to die or get their legs blown off in exchange for some medal. On average, there are 22 veterans committing suicide every day. Something clearly wrong going on here. And the irony in all of this is that Americans who thought they were delivering democracy and freedom to others lost their own freedom and democracy. Under their very noses, U.S. politicians were passing things like the Patriot Act, warrantless wiretapping, or the president's surveillance program, signed barely 24 hours after 9/11 by then Vice President Dick Cheney. They started a mass surveillance program to spy on you in the name of fighting terrorism. And it doesn't stop there. Just look at Guantanamo Bay. One of the most horrific consequences of the war on terror is without a doubt Guantanamo Bay. The Bush administration set up this prison on occupied Cuban territory and has used it to kidnap Muslim men from around the world, bring them there and hold them without charge or trial. One of the men who was taken to Guantanamo Bay is Mansour al-Daifi from Yemen. He was never charged with any crime, never mind convicted of a crime. An innocent man, he was kept in Guantanamo Bay for 14 years and only freed recently in 2016. Now he is an activist and a CAGE Guantanamo Project coordinator. He's also just released a book titled Don't Forget Us Here, detailing his time in Guantanamo. Hello, Mansour. Thank you so much for coming on the program. Mansour, for those who are not familiar with your story, with what you had to endure, could you tell us who you are, what you did before you were detained and taken to Guantanamo Bay, and how you ended up being there?
I am Mansour Daifi. Now I am holding also a number 441, because also this is my number. I think I own it. I pay 15 years for it. I am from Yemen, where I was, as you know, like, I lived for around 18 years. I grew up in was raised in a very conservative family. I finished my high school in Yemen. Then I went to Afghanistan for a research mission. Only after a few months, I was ambushed by warlord, sold to the CIA for bounty money, imprisoned in the black site, then shipped to Guantanamo.
So a warlord just wanted some money from the CIA.
As you know, when American invaded Afghanistan in 2001, they were throwing flyers offering large bounty of money for anyone who hand over foreigners or Afghanis. So according to the ACLU, that 86% of the 20s at Guantanamo were either mistaken identity or sold for bounty. People think that people Guantanamo, they were captured in the battlefield. No, that wasn't the case. Now only the research proved that only 8% who has ties to Al-Qaeda or Taliban.
Right. So that's out of several hundred, right?
Out of 800. I mean, United States wanted to send a message to the world. They can go beyond any laws. They won't abide by any law or agreements. So they created Guantanamo outside of the law, baseless legal place. Also, at the same time, Guantanamo is a military prison within a military base. It's like a black hole. So they said federal law doesn't apply in Guantanamo. Kobe law doesn't apply. Geneva Convention doesn't apply. So it's outside of the law. So they can do whatever they want. There is no accountability for what happened there. The youngest detainee was only a few months old. The oldest was 105 years old. To that extent,
what's the one common denominator between everyone who's detained there? You're just Muslim.
Yeah, I mean, yes, like all of us were Muslims. Like as I told you, 15 nationalities, 20 years spoken. All of us were Muslims. At that time, General Jeffrey Miller arrived. And he started developing what they call enhanced interrogation technique or enhanced torture technique.
Torture.
So they started like applying sleep deprivation, beating, loud music, raping, sexual assault, solitary confinement, all kind of methods. Because they used to take the Holy Quran, put it under feet, pee on it, throw
what?
It on the ground. Yeah, the interrogators, yes. Stopping us from praying, miking us. I remember when I used to pray, they would throw us the Israeli flag or the American flag. Sometime there was like, we call it the satanic room, where they have a room, and dark room, where they put candles, and the fourth is like stars and signs.
What?
It is crazy. I told you, Guantanamo was an experimenting lab. So let us finish the story. When James Yee tried to protest and tried to protest the torture in the detention, himself was accused of espionage, was accused of sympathy with detainees. He was detained, arrested and detained and interrogated. He was put in the orange jumpsuit and shackles and hooded and fly back to the United States. This is American Muslim, not getting anyone. Captain in the American Army. To the extent, imagine if they have done this with their own soldier, the one who came to serve his own country. What about us? They view us the worst of the worst, terrorists. They view us as like people who are responsible for 9/11. So when General Miller arrived in 2003, when they found out the majority of the detainees, they have no ties with Al-Qaeda. I mean, even Dan Rumsfeld, he said most of the detainees at Guantanamo there are dirt farmers, totally disconnected from the world. When we arrived there, I mean, we had no clue where we were or what's going to happen to us. We asked interrogators what I have done. And they couldn't answer us.
This is what I wanted to ask you. Did any of the guards or staff, you know, or the people who holding you captive, did they show mercy at any moment? And what happened as a result of that, if they did?
You know, Richard, you will be surprised. When they, before they brought the guards to Guantanamo, the soldiers, they used to take them to New York with the, to the, where the Twin Towers collapsed.
Ground Zero, yeah.
To and tell them that the people who are responsible for that are being detained at Guantanamo. Imagine those guards saw what happened on when they came to Guantanamo, they feel of hate and grudge. But those guards would live for us at least for 6 months or 1 year. So you cannot fool them all the time. You know, in the military, they try to program their mind to control them, to feed them with hate. And some of them honestly came to apologize to us. Some of them actually convert to Islam. Last night we had an event, one of the two former Guantanamo guards, both of them convert to Islam, alhamdulillah. And the other many stories. There were also doctors, there were nurses, there were some kind of staff who sympathized with that. They understood. But again, they're in the military.
Given everything that you've just told me, everything you went through in Guantanamo Bay, everything that's happened in the last 20 years, what do you have to say about the United States war on terror or war of terror?
Of course, it was a tragedy, and there were like innocent killed there. But what about the victims? Almost like around 1 million Muslims killed around the world. Almost like over 35 million displaced, and hundreds of thousands tortured, abused, and imprisoned. So, also those victims. So United States, actually, after 9/11, they produced their own 9/11 in every country. And I don't think those victims or families of 9/11 would agree to that policy. I don't think punishing the wrong people for what happened, I don't agree with that. Because, you know, vengeance in the wrong places, I don't think they would allow even the misuse of that tragedy to go to that extent. But what we have seen, as you know, it just, who benefit from that war on terror? Agencies, countries, individuals.
Mansour Daifi, thank you so much for your time. Really, I'm so grateful. Stories like Mansour's are the important ones. They're the ones America doesn't want the world to hear, and indeed, the most heartbreaking one. And not a single U.S. official has ever been prosecuted for any of these wars and war crimes in the last 20th century. What was this all for? The U.S. even spent 20 years saying it's fighting the Taliban. The Taliban are right back in power now, almost 20 years to the day. And in their interim government, we even find Guantanamo Bay ex-detainees. One minister even has a bounty on his head. All this time, the West has been saying it's fighting terrorism and killing terrorists, but they've actually just been killing civilians. The real terrorists were never caught or prosecuted or killed. The real terrorists were in Washington, D.C., the terrorists were in Whitehall planning the wars. 20 years, and what did they accomplish? What did this war on terror accomplish? So many people dead, so many people wounded, so many refugees. Who mourns for those victims? I ask you, where is the mourning and the grieving process for them? 9/11 was used as a pretext by corrupt politicians and corporatists to expand their empire and their profit. So yes, absolutely, mourn the 3,000 Americans, but mourn the others too, those that were killed and forgotten, those that are being killed right now, that are maimed right now, that are living under military occupation right now. The Arab and Muslim world has not even begun to recover from the fallout of 9/11 and America's response. This tragedy on 9/11 has been exploited to carry out some of the worst atrocities and war crimes and acts of terrorism, because invading others and killing them, that's terrorism. That is true terrorism. And that's what we've been living through, that's what we've been seeing, and it's still going to continue if people don't wake up and see the truth, that the war on terror has always been the war of terror. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the limelight.
It seems that the U.S. electoral system is falling apart after more than 200 years. U.S. democracy has indeed reached a dead end. It is unable to clean its ocean stables. This is undoubtedly a tragedy for the U.S. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Lee Haydong, writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Defective Electoral System is Losing Its Appeal. Stay tuned for more. Since the unrest at the U.S. Capitol, social chaos in the U.S. has gradually calmed down. But the U.S. public has increasingly doubted the Biden administration's ability to govern their country due to its poor performance handling both domestic and foreign affairs. This has reignited suspicion among Republican political elites and Donald Trump's supporters that the election was stolen. According to the latest poll done by CNN, among Republicans, 78% say that Biden did not win, while 54% believe that there is solid evidence of that, even though no such evidence has been made public. Questions about the outcome of last year's presidential election have been amplified again, reflecting the unbridgeable gap between U.S. political elites and everyday voters. Biden's attempts to narrow the U.S. deep political divisions will fail. The upcoming rally will unleash a new wave of political defamation in the U.S. Trump supporters are not going to the streets to heal U.S. divisions or put their country back on the right track. On the contrary, it is a campaign boost for Trump or the populist wing of the Republican Party, so that Republicans can regain some of their advantages in the next year's midterm elections. The CNN poll also said that 56% of Americans think democracy in the U.S. is under attack. Ever since the 2016 U.S. presidential election, people's impression of the U.S. election system can be summarized using one word: ridiculous. Elections are no longer about addressing macro solutions to the country's challenges. Instead, they are about name-calling, cursing, and denigrating candidates and their supporters. The U.S. presidential election in 2016 between Trump and Hillary Clinton was a campaign of personal aggression that reflected the hideous side of American democratic practice. The practical election in 2020 once again proved that U.S. politics are not about solving problems. Trump was voted out from the U.S. presidency, as many expected. However, after Trump left office, there has been no way for the U.S. system to hold former U.S. officials accountable for their failure to control the COVID-19 epidemic. Instead, those politicians who created this very tragedy at home continue to do nothing to help with the epidemic control. In fact, they keep using COVID-19 to gain political capital for themselves. This reveals the quality of U.S. electoral politics is so low that many of those elected are clowns who care for nothing but their own interest. It seems that the U.S. electoral system is falling apart after more than 200 years. U.S. democracy has indeed reached a dead end. It is unable to clean its ocean stables. This is undoubtedly a tragedy for the United States. According to the CNN poll, 51% of Americans believe it is likely that elected officials in the U.S. will successfully overturn the results of a future election because their party did not win. As for the series of changes to voting rules and regulations at the state level, 25% of Americans say both parties are acting in their own best interest. And just 12% say that both sides are acting to make elections fairer. The American electoral system revolves around party politics, so it is difficult to avoid interference from partisan struggles. U.S. politicians participate in elections to guarantee their future political career and the governance of their party. This is completely contrary to the focus of the U.S. political system when it was first established to defend national security and seek development and interest for the people. This shows the U.S. should really start to rethink about how to adjust and reform its political system. But indeed, it is very hard for the U.S. to do so now. In the internet era, the U.S. ridiculous electoral politics and deep opposition among U.S. voters are broadcast to the wider world. If even American people do not accept the outcome of their election in the future, then no one would believe the U.S. when it brags about its own merits. In the past, people might believe that the U.S. politics could gradually overcome its own shortcomings. But it turns out these shortcomings have instead become stubborn problems that cannot be overcome. The U.S. system is losing its appeal and more.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, aspects and principles of conduct. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Brothers and sisters, as you know, the roots of conduct has many aspects. Today we are bringing to you four of them. These four aspects primarily comprise the are the principles and the roots of conduct. Number one, conduct with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So for any individual, he or she has a relationship with Allah, the relationship with the Creator. The second one is conduct with the self. So this relationship and conduct with oneself, let it be a elderly person, let it be a youth, let it be a kid, everybody has a conduct and a relationship with themselves. The third one is conduct with the creation. So that is basically the people around that individual. Inevitably, no matter what you do, we are social beings. So we have to have connection with our surroundings. That includes other people. The fourth and the last one which we're going to discuss today is the conduct with the world, the rest of the world. People who may not be directly linked to us, but they exist. The creation around the world that exists, that is maybe not accessible to us right away, we still have a relationship with them. Each one of these aspects is based on 7 principles. And when we're discussing the conduct with this world, we are going to discuss some of those principles, which are 7 total in number. Number one, being content with what is at hand. See, when you're interacting with the world, when you have a relationship with the world, you need to be satisfied with what you have at hand. This is one. Number two is preferring what is available to what is not. Sometimes we keep chasing, keep running after something that is out of our reach. Islam says no. You look at, first and foremost, what is available to you, what has Allah provided you with. The third one is abandoning the quest for the elusive. Again, you know, running after something for the rest of your life, something that is not attainable in some cases, is not a right approach towards life. When you're dealing with this world, some people just, you know, wish to become millionaire, and their lives are spent in this quest for becoming millionaire. This is not how Islam wants to see us lead our life. We'll continue the discussion after this short break. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the aspects and principles of conduct, and we said that there are 4 of them. We're discussing conduct with this world. We went over, out of 7, we went over first 3 principles before the break. Let's quickly move on to the 4th principle. It is hating over abundance. You know, unfortunately, because we live in a consumeristic societies, we live in a world where everybody is after consuming, owning more, having more wealth. You know, we sometimes become a victim of being a lover of overabundance. Islam preaches that we have to satisfy with what we have and hate overabundance, hate accumulating wealth, hate accumulating power even, you know, unless it's, of course, for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then you accumulate and use that power. Again, you're not keeping and holding on to whatever resources Allah provides you. So this overabundance is something, generally speaking, not liked in Islam. Then we have choosing abstinence. You know, zuhud. It does not mean that you just give up your world. Abstinence is not that you don't interact with the world. Unfortunately, it's one of those concepts which is misunderstood in different circles throughout the world of Islam and beyond. Abstinence is that you should not be affected if you lose something of this worldly nature or if you gain something of this worldly nature. So for instance, a video game, right? A smartphone, a gadget, a device, you know, something, it should not change your state of heart. And this is what the higher level of abstinence is. Then we quickly move on to the 3rd one, which is knowing the evils of this world and abandoning any desires for it. You know, first you identify evils. Sometimes we look at things in a very surface level methodology and we say that, you know, we're not going to evaluate the nature of a task or of an existence and we just want to quickly engage with it. No, you don't engage with anything and everything. You're a Muslim. You don't want to be part of an evil plot, right? So first you have to identify the evil and then abandon the desire for that. Last but not the least is the negating the dominance, right? And again, this is a long topic where, you know, sometimes people have this whole attitude towards this world that I want to dominate this whole world. This is not how Islam looks at our relationship with the rest of the world. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new analysis released recently by the environmental group Friends of the Earth shows that Facebook is continuing to allow thoroughly debunked climate lies to run rampant on its platform, despite the tech giant's frequent public pledges to combat disinformation. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you, written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Analysis Shows Facebook Allows 99% of Climate Disinformation to Go Unchecked. Stay tuned for more. A new analysis released recently by the environmental group Friends of the Earth shows that Facebook is continuing to allow thoroughly debunked climate lies to run rampant on its platform, despite the tech giant's frequent public pledges to combat disinformation. To demonstrate the extent of Facebook's failure, Friends of the Earth conducted a case study of posts related to the widespread power outages in Texas that followed the devastating winter storm in February. The group found that Facebook appended fact-check labels to just 0.9% of interactions with high-performing posts, spreading the false narrative that wind energy, not the state's overwhelming reliance on fossil fuels, was to blame for the Texas power outages. That claim was quickly seized upon by Texas Republicans and right-wing media outlets, which used their Facebook pages to perpetuate the lie. The incident illustrates how right-wing extremists and fossil fuel interests weaponize social media to deride climate solutions, Friends of the Earth says in its new report, adding, the campaign rapidly expanded into mainstream media and subsequently the political arena, providing false talking points for politicians to blame renewable power and climate solutions at large for the failures of fossil fuels in Texas. Facebook and other social media platforms, the group argues, have given the fossil fuel industry's public relations campaigns a new lease on life as they offer a safe space for the worst climate disinformation. Michael Ku, Friends of the Earth co-chair of the Climate Disinformation Coalition, said in a statement that the data shows Facebook and other tech platforms must take far stronger action to limit the super spreaders and not put the burden on ordinary users. As mainstream news outlets strengthen their approach to disinformation, Facebook is becoming the last bastion of climate denial, Ku added, saying, this doesn't need to be the case. Solving climate change is difficult, but solving climate disinformation is simple. Turn it off. Friends of the Earth argued that Facebook should implement a number of policies to stop the disinformation of climate lies and other misinformation on its platforms, including disallowing climate change disinformation and hate speech in organic and paid posts and groups, creating a two-strike policy for repeating disinformers and removing viral functions at a first step, committing to monitoring climate change and identity-based hate disinformation and releasing regular third-party independent and transparent ecosystem-wide reports detailing labeled and removed content and actors. Ensure disinformation content from known disinformers is transparently reviewed by expert teams on climate denial and identity-based hate and harassment. Adopt a correct the record program that shows a retroactive correction to each other who viewed, interacted with, or shared a piece of misleading content, and establish and empower permanent infrastructure for civil rights, climate denial, misogyny, and violence against women issues, including a C-suite executive with relative expertise. The group has published its analysis and policy recommendations to coincide with Facebook's announcement recently that it is rolling out several new measures purportedly aimed at helping users engage with climate topics and ensure people have access to reliable information while reducing misinformation. In an effort to increase reliable information about climate change on its platform, Facebook said it is investing $1 million in a climate grant program in partnership with the International Fact-Checking Network to support organizations working to combat climate misinformation. Facebook also announced plans to expand its Climate Science Center, which was launched last year, with the stated goal of exposing users to factual and up-to-date climate information. Friends of the Earth and other civil society organizations responded to Facebook's new initiative with deep skepticism, who argued that for a company that makes $85 billion a year, a $1 million program that outsources the problem they have created shows that Facebook is not serious about solving climate disinformation. Imran Ahmad, CEO of the Center for Countering Digital Hate, echoed that critique, arguing in a statement that this is too little, too late from Facebook. Facebook is once again proposing nothing to tackle the spread of rampant climate misinformation or the known misinformation super spreaders using their service to lie to people, said Ahmad. Worse still, They don't even propose to stop profiting from fossil fuel advertising.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part, we saw that more than 50 countries have depleted uranium weapons. These weapons have been used extensively by U.S. and NATO forces during the past three decades, namely in Iraq and the Balkans. The consequences for both military personnel and civilians have proven to be tragic. Yet despite the evidence, the military industry and nuclear authorities continue to downplay the dangers. Don't go away, here's the rest of the program.
Our soldiers on peace missions in the Balkans are said to have been contaminated due to the presence of depleted uranium in the munitions.
My friends, we have with us Sergeant Major Antonacci. Unfortunately, you're ill. Could you tell us how this came about?
I left on August the 31st, 1998, for a six-month mission. I got the go-ahead after medical checks. During my stay in Sarajevo, I suffered several faint and dizzy spells. And a few months after I came back, these were attributed to lymphoma.
Cancer?
In Florence, I meet General Fabio Mini. In 2002, he takes command of the NATO mission in Kosovo. He's immediately concerned by the risks involved with depleted uranium, following NATO strikes in the area in 1999.
My chain of command, formed by an American admiral in Naples and the supreme Allied commander in Brussels, stood by the official directives and reports, including those drawn up by scientists in the U.S. I was therefore frequently confronted with this type of response. It's true, Fabio. You're right to be worried, but we have reports which say that there's no problem. And from a military point of view, we can't bypass them to do things that go beyond what is asked of us, and which could even prevent us from accomplishing our mission. So it was recommended that we reiterate and support among the civil population the fact that it wasn't a grave danger, that it was quite normal. And to say to the military, especially the engineer corps, treat the depleted uranium munitions like any other type of munitions. But a grenade is not the same thing as a depleted uranium projectile. I'll tell you something. In 2007, I was treated for a tumor in my colon. I never wondered if it was because of the year I spent in Kosovo. But I'll always have doubts. I still have a doubt today that it was perhaps due to that.
Politicians in Rome are mobilized, as is the government. For the first time, without waiting for definitive scientific confirmation, a law recognizes the danger of depleted uranium. When Arturo Parisi is appointed Minister of Defense in 2006, the case is one of his first preoccupations.
Our concern is that the suffering, the pain, the injuries, deaths, and damage should never go beyond by even a millimeter what has been foreseen in some way. The problem with depleted uranium, and this was what worried us, is that not only does it produce negative effects, as in the military sector almost everything produces negative effects, but also that it produces uncontrollable effects, which go beyond the present. That's the problem with depleted uranium. So from this point of view, something that might appear not too costly could, on the contrary, with time, become very costly.
Here we have a depleted uranium shell. Its radioactivity level is 40% less than what we can find here in this room.
The Atlantic Alliance is slow to acknowledge the use of depleted uranium weapons in the Balkans. In 2001, an official report estimates the quantities used at more than 3 tons in Bosnia and 10 tons in Kosovo. But NATO command refuses to confirm any link whatsoever between its airstrikes and any contamination. When I contacted the Allied Forces Communications Agency in Brussels, nobody was willing to answer my questions. In France, Alain Acariès is an inconsolable father. His son died in 1997 from lymph gland cancer. Ludovic was a soldier driving a truck in Bosnia, a truck that was contaminated, claims Alain Acariès, by depleted uranium dust since the Gulf War. He had his suspicions confirmed by an independent laboratory.
Monsieur Acariès, Mr. Acariès provided them with several samples of his son's cancerous lymph glands taken in a French hospital after his death. A powerful electronic microscope and a new technique perfected by Professor Gatti revealed the interior of the tissue.
We can clearly see the tiny particles, nanoparticles. They're not degradable, nor compatible. They're not compatible with life.
Even more surprising is the chemical composition of these nanoparticles.
There is silver, chlorine, gold, magnesium, and silicon, which form a very strange material that doesn't exist in nature.
You've been working on this case for 11 years, and you've taken legal action. What's the situation today?
Despite what was revealed by the examination, the link with depleted uranium has been denied.
But why are you doing all this?
I want the truth to be acknowledged. I want people to accept that my son was contaminated through the fault of the army, which didn't decontaminate the trucks in the Gulf. Something has to be done. We can't just let it slide. It's been the biggest tragedy in my life.
An association, Avigolf, of which Alain Acariès is a member, has been formed to inform potential depleted uranium victims, most of whom are soldiers, and to support them in their legal battles for justice. I met the magistrate in charge of the affairs filed with the county court in Paris. But the judge, Bertala Geoffroy, is naturally subject to rules of confidentiality. Despite the slow legal progress, Alain Acariès is still hopeful of winning the case he has lodged. Against him, the military institution remains rooted in its own convictions.
We're not unfamiliar with the debate, and we're taking it into account. But quite simply, we can observe that until now, no study, and God knows many studies have been carried out through the United Nations Environmental Programme, the World Health Organization, or by the International Atomic Energy Agency, and no study has highlighted or demonstrated any long-term harmful consequences on health or on the environment.
Are there any operational theatres where France has intervened recently where these depleted uranium weapons have been used?
No, these weapons haven't been used by France in any operational theatres. I would remind you that depleted uranium munitions are conventional weapons and recognized as such by every international convention. They're not nuclear weapons, which the word uranium could suggest.
France's position is in contradiction with efforts undertaken by the European Parliament. For years, European deputies have been calling for a moratorium on the manufacture and use of these weapons, with MEPs voting such resolutions almost unanimously. Monica Frassoni is co-president of the European Green Party.
The ongoing story began with strange events during the Gulf War, then continued and intensified with the war in Yugoslavia, and it became an almost traditional theme for the European Parliament. One important element, in my view, is that France and the UK have always refused to enforce bans and to support the moratorium on depleted uranium. Very often, we can see the extreme reticence of governments and armies, even of political forces, to raise the subject in public.
The urgent need for more concerted political action against depleted uranium is only more apparent when a new war breaks out, exposing new risks. My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq. In 2003, the United States attack Iraq to oust Saddam Hussein, who continues to taunt the US despite 12 years of rigorous sanctions. At the time, I'm in Baghdad, witnessing the repeated air attacks targeting the presidential palaces with depleted uranium projectiles. It's a short-lived war. In just 3 weeks, the Americans removed the dictator. Jim McDermott is not a typical American congressman. He's one of the few who have seen war close up. As an officer, he served in Vietnam, and as a psychiatrist, he has treated some of those who survived.
Mm-hmm. This, when I was dealing,
Bush lied, because I went over to Iraq and what became Baghdad Jim, not by intention, but because I was there, and they asked me what I thought, and I said, I think he's going to mislead us to get us into war. And so then we did it to all the rest of the country. I mean, and Fallujah was the Basra of 91. Fallujah was where we used absolutely awesome power to destroy that city.
In 2004, the Americans are confronted with massive insurrection. The epicenter is Fallujah. To stem the revolt, the city is bombarded. A deluge of fire rains down with white phosphorus and depleted uranium munitions. Today, peace has been restored to the city of mosques, and life has returned under the watchful eye of the Iraqi army. At the new hospital, Dr. Samira Alan shows me the tragedy she has to face every day.
They born prematurely and before they complete their pregnancy, just less than 8 months. And one of them born with a cleft lip and palate.
These babies will have surgery, right?
Of course, if he
survives.
If he survives, yes.
Yeah.
Since 2006, we start to notice that there is an abnormal increase in the incidence of congenital anomalies among the birth in our hospital. According to the cases we register, the incidence about 14.7 per thousand live birth.
What would be a normal rate of deficiency?
It should not exceed 1 or 2 per thousand. We examined 25 families from Fallujah. Those families have babies born with birth defects. We took hair sample from the kids and from the parents, and we sent these samples to an independent lab in Germany, and we found high concentration of uranium, mercury, bismuth, and other trace elements that is not usually used by human being and not naturally present in the soil or in the plants.
In Baghdad, the authorities have to take their religious leaders' opinions into account. Their voices carry weight, and their criticism is widely heard. Jawad al-Halisi is the heir to a very influential dynasty, and he protests strongly against what he sees as an attack on his people's genetic integrity.
These deformed children are the result of the use of depleted uranium. They're deformed fetuses. An international effort is required to clean up. In the same way, they brought together 30 countries and their armies under the pretext of getting rid of Saddam Hussein. They should work together on a cleansing project, like with the Marshall Plan in Germany, because the sanitary situation in Iraq is catastrophic.
Unlike after the Gulf War of 1991, the U.S. Defense Department has never published figures concerning the use of depleted uranium during the war in Iraq in 2003. Unofficial estimates speak of over 2,000 tons. Since the beginning of my investigation, I've been trying to obtain a reaction from the Pentagon. After weeks of exchanging emails, a spokesman finally responds. Dear sir, we won't be able to accommodate your on-camera interview request. The scientific community have investigated the radiological safety and environmental impacts of depleted uranium for several decades. The Agency for Disease Control and Prevention has stated that it is aware of no cancers or cases of leukemia among workers or other populations that can be attributed to exposure to natural or depleted uranium. In Washington, Time magazine called Thomas Pickering the five-star general of the diplomatic corps. He was actively involved in the international mobilization against Saddam Hussein in 2001, but he openly opposed the war in 2003.
Iraqis who say, look, we came in and created a mess and we didn't resolve it all, in my view, have some justification for their position. I leave it to wise men, lawyers, and judges to tell you whether the answer to the Iraqi is we still owe them more. But if I were an Iraqi, I suppose they would say, yeah, you've got to create a perfect paradise here.
I can understand from an armament standpoint and from a strategic planning standpoint why you'd want to have the hardest and the best weapons that could just demolish anything. They're unwilling to look at the aftermath of it and what the Geneva Convention and other things say about, you know, what you leave on the ground afterward. The military is not very well known for its ability to clean up after itself.
The official reluctance to consider the sanitary and environmental impact of depleted uranium can also be explained by economic reasons.
Obviously, from the Army's point of view, and technically, if I have to make a hole in a tank, depleted uranium is great, because it's really effective, and it's recyclable, too. I think in that situation, there's little to be said.
It's a win-win situation.
Yes, but just one detail. In Serbia, they saw that to clean one 30-millimeter head from shells that were fired, just to clean where they landed, they spent $300,000, more or less. It might be a win-win situation, but if I have to clean up afterwards...
It's a very expensive win-win situation.
Exactly, for the authorities. And those are figures that have been acknowledged and quoted.
The cost of cleaning up a zone contaminated by depleted uranium dust makes it hard to envisage that the battlefields will one day be rehabilitated. And there's worse. The depleted uranium producing countries like the US and France have to deal with the accumulation of increasingly vast stocks. More than 700,000 tons in the US, almost 200,000 tons in France. Robert Alvarez, a former advisor to the US Energy Department, has been sounding the alarm bells for a number of years.
What we are dealing with, in a certain respect, is what I call a national sacrifice.